Welcome to Alert and Oriented, the Early Learner Series, where we break down the art and science of clinical decision-making one case at a time. I'm Caroline Wang, and in this episode, we'll walk through the key principles of clinical reasoning, helping you sharpen your diagnostic skills from day one. Whether you're a medical student, a new clinician, or just someone passionate about how doctors think, this podcast is here to guide you through the process, step by step and case by case. Today, we're diving into our first episode with Rush M1, Adrian Jensen, exploring how to recognize key clinical patterns, avoid common pitfalls, and develop a structured approach to patient diagnosis. So let's get started. Hi, Adrian, how are you doing?
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. Today we have a really exciting team. We have Dr. Abrams.
Hello, everyone.
And we have our two awesome M3 hosts.
Hey guys, this is Andrew. Good to be here doing a clinical case with Adrian. I'm really excited to be involved in M1. This is the first of its kind, so pumped to be here.
And hi, I'm Sam, also at M3, and this is the genuine highlight of my very long career.
We're super excited. This is the first episode of our new Early Clinical Learner series, where we will be going through a slightly different episode layout. First, we'll have a case diagnosis. We'll have five aliquots of different information about the patient with a final answer. Then we'll have evidence for the final diagnosis, and the M3s will have an opportunity to teach back what they know. And then finally, we'll have a Q&A section with reflections and tips and tricks where we can all contribute and learn more about diagnostic reasoning. Sound good?
Sounds good to me.
And I guess the only thing I'll say, Adrian, is feel free to think out loud. This is, as Kevin would say, one of the original co-founders of Learn Oriented, don't reason in isolation.
My rocky charts will just be thrown around in the head.
Okay, yeah, so let's get started with our case-based diagnosis. I'm going to give you the first aliquot of information, and this is a general patient description. A 67-year-old male is presenting to the emergency department with complaints of progressive shortness of breath over the past 2 weeks, accompanied by fatigue and mild swelling in his lower extremities. He denies chest pain but mentions a history of hypertension and smoking, 30 pack years to be more specific. His chief complaint is, I can't catch my breath even when I'm just lying down. Just hearing that, what are some thoughts that are popping into your head?
I think for me, it's just like the age, the risk factors like hypertension, repeating edema in the lower extremities, and also just like general fatigue and exertion, but more so when he's lying down. And that gets me thinking circulation, cardiac, maybe something pulmonary because of just the fatigue. Repeating edema, I think, is the buzzword for me. Really just thinking, especially with hypertension, maybe this is heart failure or something akin to that. I like to always just start with what the patient, how it came to this or how they came into the clinic, if they were anywhere else or if something exacerbated their visit or their reason for their visit. So yeah, I think that's like where I'm at right now. And again, it's the only things we've learned too. Cardiac fall out. I'm right there in my head.
I like how you started thinking about this in terms of a systems approach. I feel like that's a great way to start to build a broad differential.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I also love that you brought up what brought them here. What were they doing before this? I think that's a really important question when you ask patients in the ED, in the clinic. That will make a big difference when you start reasoning.
Thank you. For me, going into the next steps or thinking about their visit. Where were they? What they do? Mm-hmm. Any exams that we can do? You know, just a CBC to see if there's an inflammation. And if I think cardiac, I just immediately jump to like, give me a CT, give me troponin assay. I don't know everything. So.
Yeah, you're thinking in the right direction, and we all love that you're thinking in like buckets of diagnoses. It seems like you're already thinking about these two main systems. And the next aliquot is a physical exam. You really hit the nail on the head. It's a physical exam and a cardiac exam. On physical examination, the patient appears mildly distressed. He's sitting upright to ease his breathing. His blood pressure is 145 over 90. His heart rate is 110 BPM. His respiratory rate is 22 breaths per minute, and his oxygen saturation is 88% on room air. When you're looking at the patient, you can see the JVD, or jugular venous distension, and there's also bilateral crackles heard on, and it's more pronounced at the lower base. Something to note is the abdomen is soft and there's no organomegaly or tenderness. And they also have a picture to accompany with this, and you can see the JVD that we mentioned. Just hearing that, what are some next thoughts in your head?
Okay, JVD is also hypoxic because 88% O2. Maybe some pulmonary and cardiac involvement. That always gets me thinking, since we also just learned this, cor pulmonale, which goes with the heart failure, usually it's associated with right heart failure.
Yeah.
I'm always just left to right. And for me, the biggest thing that stands out is obviously JVD, but just like the fact that he has to sit up to control his symptoms. I'm still in that heart failure line of thinking, especially with his age. I think 67 is, for me, like, the biggest highlight for that line of thinking.
What do you think of the...
Fruits, crackles, pheromones. Yes, yes. So the crackles, oh gosh, his last block was rough. But with the crackles and lung exam, then there's something calm related. Maybe something in the lungs, so it'll be like some fluid, especially with crackling.
Do you think, do you remember back from like when you guys were learning the lung exam, where... I guess if you were to hear something
near the top versus near the bottom,
does the location of the sounds like mean anything to you or up to you?
Yes, location sound. And for better now, like what diagnoses are, I mean, up and down, but different diseases, especially the pneumoconiosis, present either up or down. Mm-hmm. But I never jump to the pneumoconiosis until we get more of what did the patient do, these things. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is like more just circulation.
Yeah.
Especially with O2.
Yeah, and you're one of the living beyond. I wasn't even that. I was really, I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, what you're thinking about gravity and what sinks down.
Yes.
I wasn't even, you're going even once I thinking of differentials.
It's just some buzzwords.
I was just like, you hear something at the bottom, what goes to the bottom?
Exactly.
Okay.
I want to say one thing, because I'm reflecting on something you said before, and it really goes into this whole issue of diagnosis. And we think of history, we think of physical, and then we think of testing. And over the years, people have talked about what's the breakdown of which contributes the most to diagnosis. And so some of the old literature, so now we go back old, says 75 to 80% history, maybe 10% physical, and then 10% tests, okay? And those numbers have changed now a little bit. And the only reason I say that is because I always think of the physical as the first set of tests that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So the physical exam is you're doing these maneuvers to test your hypotheses. And then everything else is another test, is a refinement of those tests.
Just narrow down.
That's right. And so still, so today, I think people say it's still 75 to 80% history. Physical exam has actually gone down in importance, and testing has gone up in importance. So maybe it's like 75, 10, 15. And so remember that, because I still say all of this, and you did a good job when you talked about that first aliquot, all of that sort of lays out how you go and refine and move from aliquot 1 to what aliquot 4 or 5 is.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I remember thinking the third podcast episode that I came to with you guys, and you said the exact same thing, and I was like, well, now it's because I got so caught up in being in class, like looking at the lab, trying to think about, oh, what image might I have the picture to support this, and people kept saying, and I kept seeing this, like on rounds, running fours, the entire history. And then you walk out of the room before I'm even like, maybe I get to the 12th year, but I'd take the history, walk down, and there would be either like the attending or my chief, and they'd be like, what do you think it is? You'd get a differential just from history.
Just in the history.
Which is crazy. Right. But like, why if it sounds far too many of learning all these skills? They're treating us and being really big historians, because that's where the meat and potatoes of figuring out what's happening come from.
So Adrian, say you walked into this room, you thought about what you've seen so far, you know, you have this first part of the physical exam. Let's focus on edema. How would you want to assess the severity of the edema? Think simply, what would you do?
First, since it's painted, it's like how, and like, I forgot what the scale is called. It's like how long it takes for edema to come back up.
Exactly. So walk me through the steps. You go in there, and you're gonna, what are you
gonna do? Just do a full cardiac exam, and then while I'm doing that, just press in those lower extremities, just test. No, what it's called.
The time it takes for, so you compress by the shins in the lower extremities.
All right, I'm being surprised.
You gotta push hard. And then you'll let go and you'll count the number of seconds it takes for them to come back. Sometimes they might not even come back to where they started from if it's quite severe. So that's great. Sometimes we get caught up in thinking really far down the line, but what's helped me in my clinical rotations is think, what's the next thing I want to do? How is that going to answer my question or help point me in one direction? So in line with that, I think we can move on to the next part of the physical exam, which is more detailed. Caroline can detail that.
Yep, so you were exactly right. You would do pitting edema, and you would press your thumb into that shin of the lower extremities. And so what we see is pitting edema is observed in bilateral dorsal pedal surfaces on the feet, bilateral ankles extending to mid-shin. And we have a photo here that is just showing what we just described. Yep.
That's a doom, all right?
Yeah. Okay, and so...
Let's just pause. How does this, if any, change your thinking?
I think almost supports like my original just like thought process. Again, like more circulatory, like why isn't the circulation getting to these lower extremities? Like why is this edema so pronounced? If it was like something systemic or infectious, you probably wouldn't see like that more circulatory reasoning, I think. But yeah, I'm interested to see else we have that.
You don't think it's a case of elephantiasis?
No, I don't even know that word. Elephantiasis.
Yeah, I'm messing with you. I think Dr. Abrams in one of our first episodes together, he said, what are lookalikes? There's a lot of lookalikes out there. It doesn't mean you should search for those humans at all times, but it's important to maybe in the middle. I utilize that advice in the middle of my reasoning. I see patients to step back and think, what's a lookalike here?
The other thing is we use single words to describe different things,
right.
And it's too early for you to need to know this. But there's actually different types of edema, and you'll eventually see patients, and you'll be able to start thinking how to distinguish between those things, because then it's what causes edema. And I'll stop there, but it is, just like Andrew said, all these things, and in one of the most important things I think that you just said was stopping for a second and thinking is always right. You don't have to come to the answer right away.
Right.
And I think all of us think, certainly I sit here with my two colleagues here that are clinically involved in this, and you just got to stop sometime and just think.
Keep it broad.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so now we're going to move on to the cardiac exam. Upon inspection, the patient appears mildly distressed. He's sitting upright in a tripod position to alleviate dyspnea. There's no visible chest wall deformities or surgical scars, and we still see a JVD. And on palpation, the ankle impulse is laterally displaced to the 6th intercostal space at the anterior axillary line. So that's suggestive of what popped in your head just thinking about that description.
So impulse is further lateral?
Yes.
Or it's push out, so probably some kind of left ventricle, like hypertrophy,
yeah.
Or just like enlargement.
Yeah.
I got really lucky with this because my SP, when we were doing this physical exam, like when the CEs were teaching us, actually had edema and some sort of heart issue. So we got to feel it, and I was like, wow, that's wild.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got that perfectly correct. Left ventricular enlargement, there's no palpable thrills. And upon listening, there's an S1 and S2 present with an accentuated P2 component. There's an S3 gallop that's heard at the apex, indicative of volume overload, and then you also hear a hollow systolic murmur at the lower left sternal border. And just hearing that, like, where are your thoughts going now?
Everywhere. No, the S3, I think it's still in my heart failure because obviously, you know, there's something wrong with the heart. It's beating incorrectly. We're not getting that typical lub-dub that we would want to hear. That makes sense since the left ventricle is enlarged. I don't know if I said right heart failure earlier, but maybe this is left in my head. I think I remember an Anki card somewhere that said, biggest cause of left-sided heart failure is right-sided heart failure. So it might be connected.
Yeah. I'll come there really quick.
Say it again.
You're so close. You're so close with that comment you just made.
Okay.
Oftentimes, people say the biggest cause of right heart failure
is left.
Is left.
Got it. Okay. So I was getting there still.
not even thinking of a specific thing, but if you think of what are heart sounds made of?
Right.
They're made of like the valves closing against each other.
So that wouldn't cause something to be like an extra sound.
No, it's just like, you know, they're just, again, like closing inappropriately.
Yeah, exactly. Something that's like changing
the shape of the heart or the way that it's like contracting, that's adding an extra sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then the S3 is really important here because it might be different if there was an S4, for example. Does S3 make you think of any subtype of where you were heading already? And it's okay if you don't, I'm happy to help point you there.
Yeah, I think I made 18 pointers there, and it's regarding like the subcategories.
Sure, that's totally fine. Oftentimes, this isn't like 100% of the time, but oftentimes when we hear S3, we think of a dilate. When we hear S4, we think of a hypertrophy or that concentric thickening of the ventricle. That's just like a little trick when you're reading questions, when you're doing practice exams, etc. Because in reality, you're probably not going to actually hear the S3 and the S4 as a student. And maybe even as an attendant. I can't say confidently that I've ever heard S3 or S4.
Prince.
What about you?
I'm going to go back to what Sam said, and that is, I think she's right, and it's those extra sounds that should at least make you pause and say, and not say what exactly is causing them, but saying what's wrong. These sounds, and you know what's hard about this is because when you first learn them, you almost need to know what the diagnosis is in order to go back and listen to for them. Being a total novice and never doing it, and having somebody put you in a room with somebody with one of these things, say, what is it? It's hard. So like I say, it's almost like you have to see it and put it in your mind to go backwards to it. And I think that Sam, you're right. It's the more important thing is, in my mind, the more important thing, normal, abnormal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
And abnormal makes you just at least stop and pause and say, boy, this isn't supposed to be here.
And when I was on, like my medicine rotation, every single room we went in, whether someone has a kidney problem, a liver problem, they'd say listen to their heart.
And all I hear was one, two,
one, two. Until one day, I listened and I was like, listening around, and I was like, something sounds different. And then my chief was like, what sounds different? I'm like, I don't know, it just sounds different right here. And he's like, what do you think? I'm like, I don't know, it just sounds different. Right? I couldn't have told you what valve it was, so I was just like,
it just doesn't sound like one and two.
That's right.
It.
And that's all. But
everything
will make something just sound
good.
Why don't you go and listen
to
their heart?
Perfect.
Yeah, and I think in line with that, I remember the chief's surgery resume when I was on my surgery rotation was talking to me. She said, the biggest job of an intern is to come out of your intern year,
how
to recognize sick versus not sick. And so I think it's
like clinical reasoning is
the same way.
You start by just thinking in broad categories.
Yes or no. Normal, abnormal, sick, not sick. So that's
insane. I think you're on the right track. You're like, something's off for sure.
Definitely.
So the peripheral findings are similar to what we saw in the physical exam. There's 2+ pitting edema bilaterally up to mid-shin, cool extremities with diminished peripheral pulses, and the capillary refill is mildly delayed at approximately 3 seconds. So now that you have your cardiac exam, you have your PE, and you have your general patient's description, what do you think you would want to do next? And you actually mentioned this earlier, so I think you already have the next step in mind.
I think with anything cardiac, it's nice to see it, to visualize it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd want to do just like a CT, a cardiac CT, just to make sure. We know that the left ventricle is dilated, enlarged, and just having that on the screen defines it better, or confirm it.
Well, something even
simpler you might want. I'll give you a hint if there's numbers involved.
Could be not, I guess like the EKG or the CBC, but just like,
mm-hmm.
Okay, I forgot we didn't get the CBC yet. But yeah, all the CBC just will tell you so many things.
Yep, you hit the nail on the head. So the next aliquot is labs. We have a CNP, we have a CBC, and we have a BNP as well. And I'm gonna show you some of the values. And just to clue in the listeners, on the CNP, we see that the sodium is lower, the potassium is normal, creatinine is normal, blood urea is high. On the CBC, we see a low hemoglobin count, and then white blood cell count, platelets are normal. And then on BNP, or your B-type peptide, there is a 1,200 pg per milliliter value, and a normal BNP for standard is less than 100.
So definitely abnormal BNP.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So feel free to look at these labs, and I guess just when you look at them, talk through what's going on. Even if you don't know anything, don't even have to worry about fancy language, what's going on in your mind when you're trying to read these. It's okay if it's nothing.
We have an abnormal, elevated BUN. I think that the things that sound out to me the most is the BUN and the BNP being elevated.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why, whenever I see BUN elevation, I always just think, there's something kidney related, which doesn't really change my thinking too much, because when you do have cardiac issues, circulation issues, it's going to affect the whole system of the body. The edema is you're not getting blood somewhere. Other organs that need that blood aren't going to function as well. So I think this makes sense to me.
We've got a cardiologist on the way.
Yeah. I'm saying away from cardiology. But yeah, that's, I guess like where I'm at right now, I can't really think of anything extra I want to add to where I am. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you take a good approach there. When I look at this, for example, like when you're opening up Epic and you get the labs, the sodium at 135,
right.
It's gonna shine, say it's low, but really that's not
too
concerning. And then you look at it's a picture. It adds to the picture. You look at the BU and the creatinine.
Mm-hmm.
You're exactly right. They're a little elevated, like a point. Some of the things you're talking about. But really, the thing that screams at you is this
BMP.
B-type natural peptide being at 1200, which really elevated. So my question for you is, do you know what causes the BNP to be so high, and what might that point you to?
I definitely used to know why there's elevated BNP.
Would you like a hint?
I'm drawing a blank on this one.
BNP is a hormone that's released by the ventricles of the heart,
often
in response to stretch, increased tension,
oftentimes
due to volume overload. And the more there is stretching, the more there is overload, the more of that will be released. That hormone plays a role in a lot of different things, fluid homeostasis, cardiovascular, all that stuff. But simply focusing on that stretch, does that kind of help push you in some way?
Yeah, I think just thinking about all the other aliquots, and like we know that there's some fluid buildup going on here. That's what's causing the dilated left ventricle. And whenever I think fluid, I think edema, or maybe something's either bleeding into this is into the circulatory system, into the heart or lungs, or the heart is bleeding out. But in this case, fluid overload, we're thinking probably something's pumping into the heart. There's too much buildup of blood within the heart itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You're on a great path. I think it sounds like now you have the bucket of cardiac, you have renal, but you're also acknowledging it might be linked to the cardiac, and then you still have pulmonary. If you were to rank those buckets of differentials, where would you put them right now in terms of what you think is the most likely and what you think is the least likely?
I think most likely is cardiac. The renal, I mean, we have like elevated creatinine and B1, but not insanely high. And there's also no like electrolyte imbalance that would signify renal failure. So that's lower on my priority list. Palm is still secondary to cardiac, I think, because those two are tied together. But since we see this dilation, we see this fluid overload and the edema, all of this like screams, like circulation. So the main issue would be on that heart. And also just because I think going back to our history, like hypertension, fatigue, we hear crackles in the lungs, but it's not like he's like wheezing or short of breath too much. It still seems like it's most like blood related, like circulatory.
So Adrian, I agree with you, because when I hear shortness of breath, I think heart, lungs,
mm-hmm.
other, and then you can even think for a second what that other category might be, right? So you say, what not in the heart and not in the lungs would make people short of breath? And there definitely are things that do that. There's a couple things that immediately, again, I'm looking at your clinical colleagues that should flash through their mind, but not necessarily your mind. But it's common things are common,
mm-hmm.
and I'll stop there.
Yeah, I was like anxiety.
That is one. You're totally right.
Yeah, anxiety. You can think about, you know, things with the brain affecting the way you breathe. You can think about trauma. You can think about obstruction to the
pit. There's so many areas you can
go, but like Dr. Hayden said, you think with these most likely.
Yes.
And then when you rule those out, then you start thinking about the other stuff.
Ready to start.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so our next aliquot is actually something you brought up earlier. You were ahead of the game. It's imaging. So we have a picture of a chest x-ray here. On the x-ray, there is bilateral interstitial markings with a perihilar prominence. There's mild cardiomegaly, some pulmonary congestion, and blunted costophrenic angles. So how are you feeling after looking at the x-ray?
I guess feeling good, so.
Yeah.
Now, I'll
it's been
really quick here, Adrian. Do you have, and it might not because you're so early in medical school,
mm-hmm.
a framework for looking at x-rays? When you look at this x-ray, are you walking
doing
a certain way, or or is you just, okay, here's an x-ray and there's things on it?
Yeah, I feel like I always, I forgot the mnemonic that we were taught, but I was just looking at, does it look normal? Like, all these lines, all the perihilar haze that we're seeing, that's abnormal. Just looking at, does the heart look normal? And it looks like a boot here. The buzzer was just is screaming in my head. And just like checking for those typical angles that we'll see, like they're blunted or they're flattened, these kinds of things. I think it's fun to look at an x-ray nowadays, because I always wear my own x-ray to see if anything is broken. So like bones, that might be like
smart.
Traumatic.
Yeah, so let me refresh. It might be this mnemonic you're thinking of. It's the A, B, C, D mnemonic. So A for airway, you look at like the trachea, the bronchi. B for breathing, that's the lungs, the pleura. Well, bones is in the E, but we'll get there. C for cardiac, so heart's high, D for diaphragm, E for everything else. So that's the
okay.
Design for the bones. Soft tissues, maybe first foreign bodies. So it's one of those things, you have to have a mental checklist in some ways for things. EKGs have a checklist you move through, x-rays have a checklist, sometimes you'll have a checklist approach to labs, just so you don't miss things.
Mm-hmm.
That's some advice I got on my medicine rotation. But great job.
Thank you.
Right, and now we also get that echocardiogram that you asked for earlier, and we have a summary of it. The ejection fraction is 35%, and the normal range is 55%, or, and you also see left ventricular dilation with hypokinesis of the anterior and lateral walls. We're narrowing down a little bit more, giving you so many details. Where's your mind at?
Whenever I see ejection fraction, I just think HRF or HPAF, and this is definitely heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. I feel like we don't really measure, if you guys comment on this, I don't see why we would measure ejection fraction if we were not thinking failure. Right? I don't know if that's correct or too nitpicky.
When you do an echo, normally it's a number you'll get back from the cardiologist who's reading the echo, but you're very correct in that EF, ejection fraction, is really important to help with your diagnosis of something with cardiac etiology.
So hearing, after having the echocardiogram, the x-ray, labs, cardiac exam, physical exam, is there anything else you would ask for or want to inquire about for next steps?
Nothing I can think of. So yeah, if you guys have any ideas.
I think you actually said it earlier, and it really hits upon how important it is to get the history and make sure that the history is really the foundation of helping you build your diagnosis. And so you did a great job identifying every element earlier. So this is awesome. So for Alcott 5, this is some final details. We have some further history, and it's revealing that the patient has been waking up at night feeling like he's drowning, and he sleeps with three pillows to avoid shortness of breath. He's gained 8 pounds over the last month. For key medications, he has no prior use of diuretics, beta blockers, or ACE inhibitors, but he does use amlodipine 10 milligrams daily for hypertension. And then when you mentioned family history, we were able to get that father died of a heart attack at age 60, and there's no known genetic conditions. This is our final piece of information. What do you think right now?
I think that the three pillows is really like staring at me now.
Yeah.
And it's cool that we get to see the weight gain too, so tying back to just like the fluid retention or the fluid buildup within this patient. The heart attack family history is also, I guess, like very confirming that like this is most likely a cardiac issue, most likely in my head, not left side of heart failure because of a ejection fraction and the pillows. My onky cards are just rotating in my head.
Nice job.
No?
Yeah, you got the diagnosis. Heart failure, reduced ejection fraction, and you got it immediately. I think in Aliquot 3, you were already set for Aliquot 1, you were in that direction, and then by Aliquot 4, you said it out loud, and we all looked at each other and smiled, and we were like, yep, he's on the right track. So that was awesome. Great job.
Thank you, guys. If I did this during my summit, it would have felt a lot better.
We'll move into some kind of educational discussion about the case.
Please.
But I think really quick, before we do that, because it's so fresh on you, is just like a quick reflection of just how you feel to go through all of this as in your first year of medical school. Not often do students at this stage go through it at this level. So what did it feel like to you to speak on that before we jump into more?
I think it was like really confirming to what Dr. Abram said earlier. You do know more than you think. When I was coming into this, I was so I was more nervous for this than my B-side tomorrow, because I was like, I didn't do so well in cardiac. I don't know if I remember anything after running around for winter break, all these things. So it does feel good that there's some retention of information, but also tells me that there's a lot more to just learn and consider. I think this case was just like something that we learned. We only learned so little. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to stay in one block than trying to think of all the other differentials that we could have thought of. But it was really fun.
And you definitely know more than you think you do, for sure. And every time that I've been playing scenarios where people are asking me to interpret or tell you what I think, it's not like searching for the obscure thing or the name of something. It's just like, I always rely on that. I think just like half of it is going to be like, figure like everything out. It's right. Doing the right area. It's all about like how you think about it. And yeah, because most of the time, people don't actually have the name.
There's no
answer. Yeah.
Yeah.
You did a great job.
Thank you.
So yeah, I guess we'll do a little recap of some of the evidence along the way that helped support this final diagnosis. Heart failure reduced that ejection fraction. Right away on presentation, they're short of breath. They've got this, they're using these pillows to sleep at night. That's the fluid is in their lungs,
right?
Because that's really what is happening. You said it at one point. There's pulmonary things that's probably secondary to heart stuff, and that's absolutely right. Because when you have fluid that backs up onto the left side of the heart, that goes right to the lungs. And then, of course, it can continue and go to the right side of the heart. And it can even continue more, and that goes up to the jugular venous distension picture that we saw. I think you did a really good job piecing those things together. The history of hypertension is really important. Significant smoking makes everything worse. And I'll do a
little quick pop quiz,
because I just finished my family medicine rotation.
I know.
This guy is 67. He's been smoking for 30 pack years. What do you, and I guess anyone can speak on this, what do you think is, if you're following him up in clinic, what are two scans or tests you might want to do to make sure he doesn't have anything else going on?
Maybe a lung?
Absolutely.
Like biopsy or?
There's the USPSTF guidelines say that people who have had greater than a 20 pack year history of smoking and between the ages of 50 and 80 will get low dose CT scans to try to rule out any early lung cancers. You know, there's a possibility that that could be part of this as well and related to some of the in-breath pathology. Another thing you'll do with smokers between the ages of 65 and 75 is an abdominal ultrasound to check the abdominal aorta to make sure that there's no worries about an aneurysm forming, and you'll do that in men specifically. Still a bit of preventive health thrown in there. I'll pause there, Sam. You want to talk through some of the physical exam lab and anything else?
Can I say one quick thing going back to the history?
Yes.
And that is, there's one other sort of piece I think that's always useful, and that's the tempo. Okay? Tempo is over what period of time did this condition develop? And there's always ways to slice and dice this, and you could say acute, subacute, chronic. And so there are, maybe you're going to talk about this in a minute, there are clues in the history that key you in on this, because we can cut this into smaller pieces and say, is this acute or is this chronic? And I'll leave it at that. But I think the time frame of anyone's illness is a really important piece to ask. Yeah. First of all, it in some ways it defines how quickly you have to act, right? So sometimes if somebody says, I was fine 2 minutes ago, I can't breathe now, you can sit and think what's going on, but the other thing you're thinking, boy, I better get this person to breathe somehow first, and then I can go back and work all this out. So I would say that.
Or just, even if you, kind of the doctor, at this point, shortness of breath. Shortness of breath that happened 5 minutes ago, shortness of breath that happened a week ago, shortness of breath that's been going on for 3 months.
Oh, yeah.
And it, totally changes everything you kind of think about. Yeah, so.
And what's interesting with that is we have the aliquot of they've only been on amlodipine, which is a high blood pressure medication. They haven't been on any heart failure therapies. The history is so important here. And if there's a family member in the room asking them for what they noticed and things like that, to get more of that tempo. Go ahead.
So the next stuff I'll point out in this exam was the JVD, which if you think of where the jugular vein is on the right side of the heart, it demonstrates an elevated central venous pressure in the right atrium. So you think about where the jugular comes off of. You're on the right side. And it's kind of goes back to the whole backup picture that you were talking about, backing up to your right, stuff like that. bilateral crackles in the lungs, suggesting pulmonary congestion, which you got at, and then pitting edema in the lumbar extremities, indicating like fluid retention. So you're all touching that.
Yeah. And when you think about labs, we talked about this earlier with the BNP, the stretch, but with the value about 1,200, just for context, that is a very strong association with an acute, what they would call decompensating heart failure. It's, the stretch is so severe that to get that number to be so high. So I think most people seeing that number, it's a really big help to get a slam dunk here on a diagnosis, and at least move in that right direction towards helping out this patient because there's significant stretch. You did a great job talking about some mild renal impairment to the BUN and creatinine. That was really smart. And Sam's going to do a little teaching on what's called cardiorenal syndrome in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, yeah, I think we talked through some of the big points here. And what I'm impressed about, Adrian, is you were able to take these and just start piecing them together and thinking out loud. And that's what helped get you on the right direction.
Thank you.
Sam, do you want to do a little talk on cardiorenal syndrome?
Yeah, so this is also a welcome for everyone to jump in on. But that's just something I found interesting. I always find when different systems in the bodies overlap with each other and like mess with each other, I find that to be super fascinating. You can't pull a thread in a whole sheet without everything else like coming undone. But you were
already
getting at it. The definition of cardiorenal syndrome is a relationship with renal function progressively declines
as a result
of severe cardiac dysfunction. And for
epidemiology, it actually occurs in about
30% of acute decompensated heart failure. There are a bunch of different classifications that aren't super important for our purposes, but basically this little graphic on the side that I've included is showing that the heart can cause issues with the kidney, but also in turn we have problems with the kidney. It can also cause problems with the heart as well. But in terms of like pathophys, just to walk through that. So when you have systolic dysfunction, you have a reduced cardiac output, which then, like you were saying, causes your
kidneys and all the organs damaging your heart to be
hypoperfused. Which then causes your organs to be like to freak out, being like, why am I not getting enough blood? Why is there not enough fluid? And then so the kidneys then respond by activating RAS, and they start being like, oh, we need to hold on to salt. We need to hold on to fluid. That's not the kind of kidney response to this, and the only way the kidney knows how. And then causes like, it's like this like, big feedback loop where the kidney's not getting enough blood,
so the kidney's trying to hold on to fluid,
and the heart's like, wait, I can't pump, and then you're holding on more and more fluid, which then causes your lungs to get pressure, which then causes all the physical exam findings, your findings. I guess I just bring that up to say, I think those are two cool systems that interact with one another and are super relevant to like exactly what you see in the presentation.
Everything just intertwined, definitely.
Yeah.
And that's the teaching point. It's not often that things just one thing. There's often a connection. I was really impressed when you brought that up already in your discussion about secondary to pulmonary secondary. That's a really impressive skill to continue to hone in on.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about some next steps if you had a patient with HFrEF. And Andrew and Sam, do you want to teach FAF and give advice, any clinical pearls from your times on the board so far?
Yeah, absolutely. The four letters I heard the most on the GenMed floors was GDMT, which stands for guideline-corrected medical therapy, at least with patients with heart failure. So that is it's a very widely known thing of medications you want to start patients on to help them out. You would do the class of ACE inhibitors, or ARBs, or ARNIs. If an ACE inhibitor is contraindicated, you would do mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, like a spironolactone, is indicated. You could do an SGLT2 inhibitor. Those are your Flozin drugs. I'm not sure if you guys have gotten to that indication yet. You might have.
Yeah.
And antibiotics, like haloperidol, tocopherol. And then also, this is something that is not necessarily part of GDMT is there's no mortality benefit, but for symptomatic relief, you want to diurese your patients. So you want to get that fluid off of them so that they can have an easier time breathing, so that their legs aren't as swollen, so they can get more flow to their lower extremities, all those kind of things.
LASIX or something.
So definitely this patient needs to be on these because right now they're only having their blood pressure medication. So you would start them immediately in the hospital on these things, and we would see how they do. We would try to get fluid off. We'd probably be checking their blood daily to see how they're responding. We'd see how their kidneys are responding, the UN, the creatinine, those kinds of things you're saying as well. So that's like initially what you're going to do from what research has shown to help out patients with heart failure from a pharmacologic standpoint. But I'll pause there for a second. Dr. Ibn, is there anything else you consider pharmacologically?
No, I think that you've hit the highlights. Failure care in the last 10 years has really undergone a humongous transformation. Because we're starting to use medications that weren't around a lot before. People always used diuretics. People used various drugs, but There's a few new classes now. One of the things that Andrew already mentioned, the SGLT2 inhibitors are newcomers to this. When the SGLT2 inhibitors were actually first used for diabetes, and it turned out that they help people with heart failure.
Yeah.
Again, you talk about how organ systems are connected, and for God's sakes, there's going to be studies about GLP-1, so like Ozempic, there are already studies for Ozempic for heart failure, and it's going to turn out that maybe that becomes part of this guideline-directed medical therapy over time. The other thing that I want to say is, again, like I said before, we talk about conditions that are probably really heterogeneous. You diagnosed a person with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. So when I was in medical school, and actually when I was a resident, when I was a young attending, there was no such thing as heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. It didn't exist as an entity, and it first appeared in the literature maybe in the late 1990s or early 2000s as a sort of unusual disease that seemed to happen in essentially in elderly women. That's where it was first described. And so this, so all of a sudden, heart failure divides into two parts. And my answer, real answer, is that all these things change. This heart failure doesn't change, right? Because people don't change. The way we think about these things change, and the way we treat these things change. But the way you diagnose this and think about it really doesn't change. People are still presenting with shortness of breath and swelling, things like that. We may call it different things, but it's that the diagnostic piece, at least what you did today, stays the same.
Yeah. I think in line with that, like from, I've got this advice so many times, most recently on the podcast, Daniel Bacher, a Rush grad, he's in internal medicine as well. He said you should always be asking why. You don't need to ask why again. We think about that in the medical term etiology. What is causing this heart failure with reduced ejection fraction helps also get at how you can intervene in this patient's life to help them out. That's when we come into the non-pharmacological interventions. This is where getting them connected with a heart failure doctor outside of the hospital, even when they're in the hospital, to check in what's their life looking like. Is there exercise? Is there, what's their nutrition look like? How are they interested in smoking cessation? Are they drinking alcohol? These are all things that have a direct impact on this, have an impact on this person's health and their longevity after this diagnosis. And then, of course, managing their comorbidities, hypertension, if they have diabetes, obesity, sleep apnea. There's so many things that are now connected that close clinical follow-up to be able to not only up-titrate or down-titrate the medications, but ensure that from a lifestyle perspective, they're helping themselves out.
And I also think what's cool about internal medicine and then how it can also connect you to primary care too is you'll treat this exacerbation, you see the person in the hospital, but I think what's really rewarding and awesome is being to follow up with them. Like in clinic. Yeah, in clinic later, and what Andrew was saying about lifestyle modifications, like patient education, and then managing all their comorbidities too. That's what keeps somebody alive. So your diuretic helps them symptomatically. These medications, if they take them, help them, but I think like all the whole big picture of all that kind of stuff is cool to see how it like fits.
Making sure you're just not involved in the band-aid process, but like the overarching process.
That's absolutely right. But I think with that, a couple more, just now into the more reflective stage. It was nice to hear how it felt for you and that you believed you knew more than you thought you did. So the question we thought would be interesting to ask you, like, what did you find to be most helpful in the process of moving towards your final diagnosis? And yeah, how might you apply that moving forward?
I just think the systematic thinking, I don't know so much about very few systems currently, but the more we build on it, like how do these all interact with each other, like how does it start? I always run to the heart first nowadays because it's like, I guess, the major structure that we've learned of so far. But it's cool to put it all in like different quadrants and then start checking off. And each aliquot gives you more information and kind of narrows things down. So it's fun where it's like it feels more, also that I didn't know something like you were saying earlier, like right away. And I have a giant list of things, and I'm really just tacking things off one by one.
I think as I was writing this case, originally I thought, this is a clear cut, you'll get it. Yeah. But then as you were going through it, you were bringing up so many great points. Everything is so connected. It's called cardiometabolic disease for a reason. It really does affect every system. And so I really liked how you pulled out different threads of, I think this could affect renal, and also how could it affect pulmonary. And I think I can really see a zest for understanding the why whether that's like talking about the pathophysiology or the cardiorenal syndromes. And then I think you were applying that because right away, when we mentioned the fluid buildup, you started asking yourself, why is the fluid buildup? What could have been the causes? And behind that, even further, why would that happen? In the future, what advice or tips or strategies do you think you're going to keep using to further build upon your clinical diagnosis development skills?
I think just like keeping it broad, like never, I think it's very easy to get stuck on the Anki card and exactly what it is, this is the answer.
Yeah.
And just being more open and knowing that everything is intertwined. Could have been like some trauma, could have been all of this, like everything, mm-hmm. and not getting too lost in the weeds.
Yeah,
I think that's excellent, and to be honest, it's good advice for me as well. The more you get into, go through medical school, the more information you pick up, and that adds wonderful detail, but sometimes it can lead you astray. So my lesson is to step back, think simply, and relish in the big systems and the early learning phase that you're in. I think it's just such an excellent practice to try to do these things. A big kudos to you, Adrian.
Thank you, guys.
You did an amazing job.
Yes.
You truly did.
Stressed.
And I want to say that I wrote the question before you even started. I was like, what do you think is most helpful in helping you choose your final diagnosis? History, physical, lab, and imaging. So my lesson or takeaway, again, is just like being reiterated that the history is like everything. And what's cool, again, about like the preclinical experience, they're really forcing you guys to become great historians. So like when you guys
show up on day one and you
don't have the answer to whatever, you're going to be able to get 70-80% of the way there from getting a really great history. So that's true.
Yeah. Okay, that was a great episode. Thank you so much, Adrian, for being our first guest on the Early Clinical Learners mini-series for Alert and Oriented.
I'm very honored.
Yeah, we can't wait to see you in the next episode.
Oh, gosh. I'll have to get ready for that one, too.